KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected, on the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, Bay Area comedian and TV host W. Kamau Bell tells us about some of his toughest interviews, from talking with a hooded Klansman about white supremacy to asking his nearly 80-year-old mom about her sex life.
It made me blush. There was a couple points where I was like, that's enough, where I cut her off. You're not supposed to do it in an interview, but it was my mom.
Plus, we meet an astronaut from San Diego, the first Latina to go up into space. And we head to an L.A. auto body shop to meet a young dreamer born in Indonesia who says when you're undocumented and Asian, you're invisible.
You go through all these struggles and you can't really feel like you identify with other folks who also go through that struggle. It's kind of like, oh yeah, we have this support system for you, and especially we can cater to you if you speak Spanish. And I'm just like, what about us, you know?
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. We're starting off our show this week with a flashback to the 90s.
Hi, I'm Tabitha Soren, and this is MTV News.
Some of you might remember these sounds and the voice behind them. Tabitha Soren's the former MTV News anchor who once covered Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns. She interviewed stars like Mariah Carey and Tupac. These days, she's behind a camera. She's a fine arts photographer. And her muse? Baseball. The Oakland A's. KQED's Kevin Jones caught up with her at her new workplace.
Tabitha Soren and I are sitting behind the bullpen, watching the Oakland A's host the Houston Astros.
That'd be fun if we caught a ball.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't bring a glove. We're such nerds.
During our 8 years on the MTV news desk, Soren brought journalistic gravitas to a network that focused on celebrity and drama. She later moved to the Bay Area with her husband, Michael Lewis, and while he was working on his book, Moneyball, they went to a lot of Oakland A's games.
And I met a draft class who was arriving at spring training for the very first time, and I saw all these kids with their faces full of hope, all going to work toward being on a major league team. And they were drafted out of college, many of them left college, and I thought, wow, wouldn't this be great to shoot their picture every year and see how their faces change, because they can't remain this hopeful.
That idea, born 14 years ago, became her newest book of photographs, Fantasy Life. Her dream of chronicling the players losing their faith in the game didn't pan out, because the changes weren't as visual as she hoped. But what Soren did find was a whole other world built around what she once thought was America's most boring pastime.
Even the guys in the dugout, they look so bored in half of my pictures, making sculptures out of peanut shells or tobacco cans, and you know, the things that go on in there are not scintillating.
But Soren found a way to bring out the more artistic qualities of the game. She experimented with tintype, a technology first developed in the 1860s, and made for beautiful images that, unlike other sports photographs, didn't depend on action or celebrity. One of her favorite tintypes is of a player bending over. Doesn't sound like much, but there's a whole story behind the pose.
He struck out, and there were bases loaded, and they could have won the game, and it was the division championship. They could have won the whole division. And, you know, bless his heart, he just decided to hang there for a while. And I just feel like that picture of defeat is so incredible and poignant. There's so much pathos in that shot. And the tintype makes it way more beautiful.
I'm at batting practice with the Oakland A's, talking with infielder Chad Pinder, who's the subject of many of Soren's photographs. He was a good sport when it came to her vision.
I remember we were in Modesto, and she had us like mimicking a bunch of famous paintings, and I also remember her being around the dugout and taking pictures of us all throughout the summer.
But you didn't know about her being on MTV and her time as the face of MTV News?
No idea. And I didn't know that until right now.
Billy Bean, the A's longtime general manager, says he granted Soren access to all the players because of her dedication to the project. Bean's the first to admit he's not much of an art fan, but over time he says he came to appreciate Soren's work.
Projects like this, I have to sort of grow into, but with an open mind, so to speak. I thought was really cool a little bit was just the different, I mean, it wasn't just the subject, it was some, how some of the photographs were actually taken, the time of day they were taken. And so I sort of appreciate that, but I don't pretend to, you know, when I go look at a Monet, I don't quite get the colors.
Soren says her book Fantasy Life tells a California story because it's about second chances. She cites the career of pitcher Joe Blanton. He was drafted by the A's in 2002 and later went to the Dodgers on a contract worth millions. But he didn't fulfill his potential, and after a couple years, Blanton retired and started a winery in Napa Valley. A year later, Blanton was back in the majors, and he's still pitching today.
This is the land of second chances. I feel like my photography has definitely been my second act. Art has given me another chance at a career. And in baseball, when the game is so young that it's very unusual for a veteran to come back and impress anyone. And Joe Blanton is totally doing that. If that's not the California dream, I don't know what is.
For the California Report, I'm Kevin Jones in Oakland.
If you want to check out those baseball photos up close, you can see them at San Francisco City Hall starting in July. And now we're going to talk with Bay Area-based comedian W. Kamau Bell. He's known for his work exploring themes of race, identity, and politics. Here he is on his Showtime special called Semi-Prominent Negro.
A new thing that has happened, a new response to white people who are trying to be your friends, they think they're helping you. Like that thing, that horrible thing happened in South Carolina where the young girl, black teenage girl, was thrown across the room by the cop, and it was horrible. And it was like a 15-second video. And there's white people going like, I need the whole story. But a cop walks over, picks up a black girl, throws her across the room. Yeah, but that's only 15 seconds long. I need the whole story. When are we going to get the whole story? I just feel like, all right, this is what I do. Do this. You want the whole story? Our story begins during the transatlantic slave trade.
There was a big boat, and black people were packed on tight, and they shipped us across the water. Then they made us work.
His new book is called The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. Tales of a 6'4", African-American, heterosexual, cisgender, left-leaning, asthmatic, black and proud, blurred, mama's boy, dad, and stand-up comedian. And he's here with us in studio on the California Report magazine. Welcome, Kamau.
That's a good joke. I mean, that's what I just want to own. Every now and again, I write good jokes.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, I only did that joke for a few months before the special, so I've sort of missed that joke. That was a good joke.
Okay, but I got to start by asking you about this title, because yes. This is like the biggest mouthful ever.
Yes.
Why did you decide you had to put in all these identities into the title of your book?
I took one of those learning annex classes, from Fiona Apple and how to title things. I believe the title should tell you what's happening. And so for me, I just have fun putting as many words as the publisher would allow.
Well, you've got a lot of identities in here. One of them is Mama's Boy. And mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I had the privilege of meeting your mother because I was at the Third Coast Audio Festival and we were all getting awards. You guys won an award for a podcast that I love called The Longest Shortest Time about parenting. And you took on asking your nearly 80-year-old mom about her sex life.
So what was, were you having an active sex, I can't even say it, you were having an active sex life?
Yes. Yes, I was.
An active, pleasurable, fully?
Yes.
Fully everything?
Yes.
Okay.
I was.
And so that's why you had the queen size bed?
Mm-hmm. I needed more room.
I just thought you liked the big bed.
I did.
I guess so.
It makes me blush, like, just to hear you ask her that stuff.
Yeah.
What was it like to basically interrogate your mom about her sex life?
I mean, it made me blush. There's a couple points where I was like, that's enough, where I cut her off. You're not supposed to do it in an interview, but it was my mom. And I don't do that. I don't normally do that with people in interviews. For me, it was like, it's funny, a lot of the work I do, people sort of talk about it as something that I'm doing for maybe the world or for my community. It's really all pretty selfish. And so that conversation was something I wanted to talk about my mom. I wanted to have that conversation with my mom for a long time because I just really didn't know what was going on. And we're really close. And there was just one aspect of her life that we hadn't talked about. Her dating life. Not really her sex life, but her dating life. I've listened to that like 3 or 4 times. Like, and I listen to it now, like, I should listen to it again because it really was like, it was everything me and my mom's relationship is. It's super close. It's not the standard son-mom relationship. And it's also like we're having a great time.
Well, so another part of this book is about your own life, you know, as a dad. And you're married to a white woman. You got 2 girls who are mixed. And, you know, you talk about how sometimes when you're with them in a crowd or whatever, sometimes people don't recognize that you're their dad. Mm-hmm. And I totally get that because my dad is from India. My mom is white and I'm very fair skinned. I have blue eyes. And, you know, I just think a lot about like how you navigate that as a parent when you're teaching your daughters to have pride in their identity, but they also have like some level of privilege within that identity.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting right now because we're realizing, because our oldest daughter is almost 6 and our youngest daughter is 2.5, that they, while they are clearly sisters, our youngest daughter is much lighter. Her hair is much thinner, like it's not as kinky as her sister's, and we're like, oh, they're gonna have very different experiences. Like, you know, my wife is like, and this is, my wife is hashtag woke, she's like, Juno's gonna pass, like, which in the community, that's how inside the community my wife is, passing is a thing we say inside the community, so that she's gonna be able to pass for white if she stays with at the complexion she is now, which we think she is. And it's just like, wow. And there's 2 things there. That Sammy, as mixed people get, will probably be exotified by some people, which we've seen some of that already. Oh, my God, you're so cute. There's a joke on my special about that. And Juno may not be exotified, which is like some people, which is also like, why can't I be exotified? You know, like there's that. But she will be able to get into spaces and hear things that Sammy won't be able to get into and hear. So there's a level of privilege there. And we're like raising, it's like you have to have 2 different manuals, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. Every parent has different manuals for different kids in their house, but I'm saying like 2 very, and also while at the same time, both of you use your powers for good, but also understand that you're living different lives, but you're still sisters.
Mm-hmm. And also have pride in who you are, no matter what you look like.
And no matter what Juno looks like, she's black. You know, it's just like, that's just the nature of the America game.
So now you're reaching a broader audience with your CNN show, United Shades of America, which is basically you taking a road trip across the country and you're exploring the challenges facing all these different communities. You're also putting yourself in some pretty vulnerable situations, like interviewing members of the KKK and white nationalists like Richard Spencer. I just want to play a cut from that.
Oh, yeah.
What do you love about white privilege?
Oh, it looks great. Like, you know, I mean, the people are good looking and, you know, nice suits, great literature. Like, yeah, I just want to bathe in white privilege, the greatest, most awesome thing.
It's working out for you.
Well, yeah, I want to expand white privilege. We live in a world where...
So you write in the book about the challenges of entering into the world of television when so many of the producers and the crew members are white and mm-hmm. feeling like sometimes they don't have your back when you're going into these situations, like going into the woods to interview a fully hooded Klansman or talking to somebody like Richard Spencer.
Yeah, I will say that like in the book I really write about specifically around the Klan experience, by the time we got to Richard Spencer, we had made a lot of changes on the crew. So once that interview ended and we sort of like had everything we needed, we'd been there for hours, the people of color were able to sort of huddle up and have a meeting and go like, how you doing? Are you okay? You're okay? Whereas with the Klan the season before, it's not that the producers and crew didn't have my back. They had my physical back, but they didn't have my racial back. They didn't have my, like, how is this affecting Kamau? You know, he feels maybe physically safe, but how is this affecting him emotionally and mentally? And nobody knew how to reach out. Maybe they wanted to. And we still employ a lot of people. All the camera guys in the first season, eventually I formed a very deep friendship with them. And, like, you know, now I feel like we're all waking up together. You know what I mean? They're all like, I talked to Patrick, the DP, and he's like, I can see him every time we film, like, oh, I really get this, which is great. But not everybody was having that awakening.
I got to ask you, among your many projects, you have a podcast called Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period. And I totally get the premise of it. But yes, seriously, how do you squeeze out 118 episodes of riffing on Denzel?
Well, first of all, we didn't realize how many other people out there felt the same way we did. So, you know, we got a lot of like first of all, fans from the very beginning, but also then other actors would come on and want to talk to us, people who'd work with Denzel or people who just admired his work. There's a lot of talk in Hollywood or just about like, man, Tom Hanks is so great. Will Ferrell is so great. And me and Kevin Avery, who's also from the Bay Area, my co-host of the podcast, were like, how come Denzel's not in that conversation? So it started as a way for us to claim that he should be in that conversation. But instead of going, Denzel's among the best actors of all time, we're like, we're going to be definitive. He's the greatest actor of all time, period.
And it's another long title.
A long title. I believe in long titles.
All right, Kamau, it's been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
W. Kamau Bell is a Bay Area comedian. He's the author of the new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. Every week, the California Report magazine takes you on a journey around the Golden State. We've just heard stories from the Bay Area. Next, we're going to head to San Diego and L.A. And by the way, if you're stuck in traffic this Memorial Day weekend, take a road trip for the ears. Subscribe to our podcast. And let us know what you think about our show. Send us a note on Facebook or at calreport@kqed.org.
Minus 10, 9, 8. We have a go for engine start. 6,
that's the
5,
sound of the
4,
Space Shuttle Discovery
3,
taking off in 1993. Aboard that mission was the first Latina to travel to space. She grew up near San Diego, and this month she was inducted into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. Meet Ellen Ochoa.
Well, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and that was an exciting time for the country for space. Of course, everybody was watching the Apollo program. So to a certain extent, I would say everybody was interested in space. But of course, at that time, there were no women astronauts. They weren't allowed to apply. And actually, you saw very few women at all working at NASA. So it wasn't something that at that time I ever thought about growing up and doing. When I went to graduate school at Stanford University, it was the same year that the space shuttle flew for the first time. And that, of course, was a very different kind of spacecraft that had ever flown before. And it was going to carry a number of crew members. And for the first time, astronauts had been selected who were women and minorities. And it was really all those things put together that got me very interested in applying to the astronaut program.
We have liftoff of Discovery on the second mission to Planet Earth research flight.
Houston now controlling. Discovery is underway and it's rolled on course for a 57-degree orbit.
Going into space is very exciting. First of all, the launch, of course, is very dynamic. A lot of changes in acceleration. You get to a maximum of about 3 Gs, which it feels like you weigh 3 times as much as you're normally used to weighing. And then when the engines cut off, you go to zero gravity. So it's a very abrupt transition and very interesting, of course. And then we had a great opportunity to view the Earth from space. And because of our mission, we were traveling in an orbit that was inclined 56 degrees to the equator. So we were really traveling over the entire populated portion of the Earth and could see essentially every continent except Antarctica. So being able to view the Earth while we were collecting data on the Earth's atmosphere was just a really exciting experience.
I must say it's a little bit hard to keep my concentration because I'm looking out the aft windows at some great views of South America right now. But we'll continue to look.
That is a very pretty picture we're still looking at down here. Great work, Ellen.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to be on 4 space shuttle missions, and 2 of them were studying the Earth's atmosphere, primarily the problem of the ozone hole and ozone depletion. And then the second 2 were part of assembling the International Space Station program. When I applied to the Astronaut Corps, and even when I was selected, I really didn't think that much about my Hispanic background or what that might mean. But after I became the first Hispanic woman in space, of course, I got all kinds of invitations to come speak at schools, for example, schools with high Hispanic populations, other groups that were encouraging Hispanics and young women to study science and engineering. So I've had the opportunity to give actually hundreds of talks and interact with students all over the country and even around the world. My mother, Roseanne Ochoa, was the person who had the biggest influence on me. She, of course, encouraged all of my siblings as well as me to go pursue whatever we wanted to do. But she was always very interested in education, interested in learning, loved learning new things, and she really passed that on to all of us.
That's astronaut Ellen Ochoa, who grew up near San Diego. She went on to log nearly 1,000 hours in space. She's now the director of NASA's Johnson Space Center. This month, she was inducted into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. Our profile of her was produced by Marisa Cabrera from KPBS in San Diego. Here on the California Report magazine, we've met young immigrants known as dreamers, people brought to the U.S. as children who have relief from deportation, at least for now. Many of them are born in Latin America. We rarely hear about dreamers from Asian countries, and they face unique challenges. Stephanie De Leon-Sik brings us this profile as part of our series, At Risk in the Trump Era. It's a collaboration with student reporters at the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
It's a typical Southern California scene. A guy and his friends hanging out in the Nauta shop, talking cars and teasing each other.
And you had the red car, and then like a month after or so, you painted it with bathtub paint in white, and it looked freaking terrible. And it was the worst thing I've ever seen.
Alvin's 27. He works as an accountant, he's a huge hip-hop fan, and he's deep into cars.
Like, I've always loved cars ever since I was a kid. Like, that was literally what I've always played with.
The shop is every car guy's dream. It's a place where they can customize their favorite car, the Nissan 240SX. But it's also a space where Alvin can forget about his legal status. When Alvin was 2, his parents brought him to the U.S. from Indonesia. They overstayed their tourist visas. The family tried to stay under the radar for decades. They relied on a slim network of other Indonesian migrants in Los Angeles.
We hit up a friend of a friend of a friend who led us to this restaurant owner. And that restaurant owner, who happened to also be Indonesian, agreed to like take us in for a bit. So we came through and we actually lived at the restaurant for about 3 months. My parents did work at the restaurant during business hours, and at night we would go up to the attic and sleep.
His family wanted to get their green cards, but there was no way to do it. They didn't have any relatives who live here legally and could apply for their visas, so they stayed underground. Alvin says being Asian and undocumented can be a really alienating experience.
That was like the loneliest I've ever experienced, because like it's one of those things where you go to lawyers and stuff and they're all like, oh yeah, we have this support system for you, and especially we can cater to you if you speak Spanish. And I'm just like, what about us? You know, it sucked. Especially because like you go through all these struggles and you can't really feel like you identify with other folks who also go through that struggle. So you just kind of like stay in your own pocket of world.
He found comfort in car culture. Even though every time he got behind the wheel, he was taking a risk.
Getting my whole life potentially ruined and getting deported off just the fact that I was driving without a license.
5 years ago, Alvin was among the first young immigrants to apply for DACA, President Obama's deferred action for childhood arrivals. He could finally stop worrying about getting pulled over, losing his car, or getting deported.
It was a life changer. I then applied for my Social Security card and a bunch of other stuff and my California ID and driver's license. To be real, like, it is probably has been the biggest life changer for me. It's not just a work permit. It's literally the freedom of being able to go out there without being scared to get caught.
His new status helped Alvin become the sole provider for his family. It's hard for his elderly parents to do manual labor anymore, and they're pretty scared about being undocumented.
They don't have a safety net, you know? Like, I have deferred action, you know?
Yeah.
But my parents don't have...
Soon after President Trump took office, Alvin brought his parents to a Know Your Rights forum. He wanted them to be ready in case immigration agents showed up at their house.
Like, it's better that they are aware and knowledgeable about what to do, you know, and lawyer up. You know, just like knowing is power. Knowledge is power.
And for the most part, Alvin feels empowered. He says he's not afraid of this new administration. But he's also asked me not to use his full name for this story or reveal the town he lives in. He also didn't want me to interview his parents. But he's happy for me to meet the next best thing.
Yeah.
His car family. They're not Asian or undocumented. In fact, they're mostly African American.
I met Alvin through Shane, who had his own little hobby shop next door.
That's Rob, one of Alvin's car buddies. He owns a detailing shop in Compton.
So I would come up here and learn more about the cars, and that's how I met Alvin. It was one of the days that I think it was the day that we set the car on fire, you know. But I
that's
mean,
another story.
Yeah, that's another story. That's another story. You gotta pay for that.
The shop is a chance for Alvin to forget about his immigration troubles and talk about what he loves the most: cars.
We try to keep like politics aside for the most part, just because like it's a space that we want to keep just lighthearted and fun, you know.
Because being undocumented is just one part of who he is. For the California Report, this is Stephanie DeLeon-Sick in Los Angeles.
And that's our show this week. The California Report magazine is a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Nina Thorson. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. And we had additional engineering from Katie McMurrin. Special thanks to Sandy Tolan and Karen Lowe at USC. Our online producer is David Marks. Sarah Craig is our intern. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maudion. Our editorial team includes Susie Racho, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.